This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for November 2012. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scherer, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we're going to hear from Ricky Laurentis.
Even as your chest fills with a strange new air.
And Idra Novi.
If there's a craft to the failing of simple expectations, I have mastered it, and majestically.
Then we'll talk with Clive James about how poetry worms its way into the mind.
It starts being unforgettable straight away, and it drives everything else out of your head.
We also have work by Haley Lighthouser, Donald Revell, and Katie Ford, to name just a few of the other poets in this issue. And we also have an unusual thing. We have a few photographs.
Yeah, from the earliest days of Poetry Magazine, the editors have always requested photos from contributors. So, as it turns out, we now have thousands of photos on file here in the office.
You know, I think originally this was Fred Sasaki's idea, or maybe your idea, I don't remember, but the well, two of you.
we used to go looking through these old files, and we would try to guess before turning over the other side. We would try to guess who they were. And
some of them are funny. Ivor Winters, a famous West Coast critic, middle part of the 20th century, sent in a picture of this regal-looking Airedale as his author's photo, and he says, note the in-stress of the inscape. This dog is a finer work of art than are most of the poems published in poetry.
Yeah. But I think some of the photos are just curiosities, but then some of them are really well-known poets very early in their careers, and you can see very young photos of Robert Pinsky and Louise Glück, and so they're quite interesting. And we also have a picture of some folks who were rejected.
That's
by
right.
Magazines.
They call themselves the rejected generation, right? There's a sign with saying the rejected generation above their heads.
Yeah, they met in a basement somewhere.
Right. So they didn't actually ever get in the magazine, but now they're...
Now they made it at last.
Now they're here. Before we get to the recordings of poets reading their own work, Don, was there a particular poem that you liked this month you want to start with?
Well, we mentioned Haley Lighthouser, and she's been in the magazine several times. Her poems are such fun to read and to hear, so I thought I would read this poem of hers called Mockingbird. No other song or swoop, part quiver, part swivel and plash, with tour de force, stray the course, note liquefactions, its new body air and aria hangs in, enthralls, trills, loops, soars, startles, out warbles, out bronze, more juicily, lifts up the dawn, outlaws from sackcloth, the cool sloth of bedsheets, from pillows and silks and blue quilted feminine bolsters, fusses of coverlets, nips as the switch of a juvenile willow, fuzz of a nettle, to window and window and window and ever toward egress, to flurry, pollen and petal shed, to wet street and wet pavement, all sentiment, intemperate, all sentience, ephemeral.
It's lovely. You can tell she's heavily influenced by Marianne Moore. Her favorite poet is Marianne Moore, and this poem sort of creeps down the page. I love that. Lifts up the dawn, outlaws from sackcloth, the cool sloth of bedsheets. Those sounds together.
Yeah.
It seems to at once banish sadness, outlaws from sackcloth, and yet to admit sadness in the end, all sentience, ephemeral.
Yeah.
Kind of the ephemeral nature of this creature, which itself is a emblem of joy for her.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that I liked a lot, A Different Tone, by Katie Ford, who's not been in the magazine before. It's called Foreign Song, a short little poem. To bomb them, we mustn't have heard their music or known their waterless night watch. We mustn't have seen how already the desert was under constant death bells ringing over sleeping cribs and dry wells. We couldn't have wanted this eavesdropping of names we've never pronounced, praying themselves towards death. I try to believe in us. We must not have heard their music.
I guess I've never quite thought of this. That part of what humanizes us is to relate to other people and their culture, you know,
yeah,
and the music and the prayers that belong to them. It seems like such an obvious thing to know, and yet this poem tells us this very emphatically, you know, to bomb them, we mustn't have heard their music. And then at the end of the poem, we must not have heard their music. They're insistent in its own music.
Saying we couldn't be so barbaric as to have heard the music they make and then bomb them, right?
Yeah.
That's, I try to believe in us.
Yeah, who wants to steal someone else's music like that?
And this poem seems to suggest, if we enlarge the definition of music to include poetry, seems to suggest that poetry is one of the ways in which we humanize other people. We recognize them as humans. If we had understood the poetry of Iraq, could we have bombed them? That's essentially what this poem is saying. All the images are from the desert.
Yeah, but if you define them as foreign, it sort of allows you to gloss over their humanity.
In the November issue, we also have poems from 2012 Ruth Lilly Poetry Fellows. Every year, the Poetry Foundation and Poetry Magazine award five annual fellowships of $15,000 each to young writers.
Two of the fellows, Reginald Duane Betts and Jacob Sines, have previously had poems in the magazine, but this is the first appearance of Ricky Laurentis.
Ricky Laurentis is currently living in St. Louis, where he's completing an MFA at Washington University. But he comes from New Orleans originally, and in 2005, Hurricane Katrina drove Ricky and his family out of the city.
His neighborhood withstood the high winds, but not the water.
We stepped outside, and there was no water, and then 30 minutes later, there was like knee-high water that had just come from nowhere, and it was just steadily rising. And that's the sort of psychic rupture I'm kind of talking about, just like the day before, your life was one way, and now it's this way, and now you're a survivor. What does that mean?
That psychic rupture informs the two poems you're about to hear. The first got its start not in Katrina, but in a phrase that Ricky once overheard.
And the phrase was, history of trees. And I started to think that if trees could talk, some of the knowledge they would have to say probably would be quite gruesome. So the poem started from that inquiry and sort of changed over time into what it is now.
Here's Ricky Laurentis reading Southern Gothic.
About the dead having available to them all breeds of knowledge, some pure, others wicked, especially what is future. And the history that remains once the waters recede, revealing the land that couldn't reject or contain it. And the land that is not new, is indigo, is ancient, lived as all the trees that fit and clothe it are lived. Simple pine, oak, grand magnolia, he said they frighten him, that what they hold in their silences, silences. Sometimes a boy will slip from his climbing, drown, but the myth knows why. Sometimes a boy will swing with the leaves.
That's a devastating little poem. I mean, that last image makes you think for a minute of Robert Frost, but then, of course, it makes you think of black people hanging from trees.
Yeah,
right?
Lynching.
Right.
Like the song Strange Fruit.
Right.
It's very haunting. And even listening to him read the poem, it occurs to me that, I mean, I'm from Tennessee, and I suddenly realized all the streets where I come from are named after trees. I think it's something about that part of the country. I think when I lived in New England, a lot of streets were named after presidents, for instance. There's something about the landscape, as he's described it, where even the, you know, the names of the trees, simple pine, oak, grand magnolia, they're like shorthand for all of the things that have unfolded in and afflicted the landscape and the people there.
I like the way the poem begins, sort of in medias res, that about the dead having available to them all breeds of knowledge in the middle of things. You know, the poem is about history and just sort of steps into the middle. In mid-stride, you pick up the poem, and not until the end do we get those subject-predicate sentences.
Sometimes a boy will slip from his climbing.
Suddenly it gets very straightforward, but the whole poem until then has sort of caught you up in this flow.
And the flow is really what the poem so adroitly addresses, that flow that is not just the linear unfolding of history or a progression, but his eye is very keen and he observes that in the flood, there's history once the waters recede. In other words, the landscape is revealed differently after it's been changed.
And the land that is not new is indigo, is ancient.
It's indigo.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. Would suggest blackness, suggest a bruise.
You know? Yeah, or maybe Twilight.
Twilight,
even.
Yeah.
It's foreboding, but very, very beautiful.
Let's hear another poem.
So this poem is my attempt to meditate about the kind of psychic space one experiences in a moment of trauma, at a moment near death, particularly drowning. It's my way of trying to figure out what's the capacity of the human spirit, I suppose.
This is You Are Not Christ, with the subtitle, New Orleans, Louisiana.
For the drowning, yes, there is always panic or peace. Your body behaving finally by instinct alone, crossing out wonder, crossing out a need to know. You only feel you need to live, that you deserve it, even here, even as your chest fills with a strange new air. You will not ask what this means. Like prey caught in the wolf's teeth, but you are not the lamb. You are what's in the lamb that keeps it kicking. Let it.
This poem is put together so differently that the other, I mean, we both use the word flow because of what history suggests. This one is in these little gulps, little gasps,
exactly.
I guess.
That's the right word, yeah. It's so powerful and so compact.
Even as your chest fills with a strange new air, you will not ask what this means.
And that yearning to ask or know what something means, but you can't, is amazing to me.
Well, there's a theological term called apophasis, where something gets unsaid as it's being said.
Mm-hmm.
So George Herbert says, "Let me not love thee if I love thee not." Or Meister Eckhart says, "We pray God to be free of God." And this poem is, "You are not Christ." But then at the end we get,
"But you are not the lamb."
And of course the lamb is associated with Christ.
"You are what's in the lamb that keeps it kicking. Let it."
And so there's at once a denial of the kind of power of religion and then a seizure of that power at the end.
Yeah.
It sort of does those two things at the same time.
And a kind of prayer, too, in that let it.
Let it.
It's a powerful poem.
Yeah.
If you live or have ever lived in New York City, you're probably going to be familiar with this problem. Your apartment's small, and you live in a city that all of your friends and relatives want to visit.
Idra Novi is a poet and translator who lives in Brooklyn.
And because I'm married to a foreigner, we have constant house guests on our sofa bed. I would not tell them that sometimes they have used the same sheets.
Well, that ought to staunch the flow of guests, perhaps, to Idra Novi's house. In any case, the experience led her to write a series of house guest poems.
Although, as is the nature of poetry, as I worked on these poems, the house guests became more and more unusual.
Here's the first poem.
The visitor does no dishes, dribbles sauce across the floor, is more dragon than spaniel, more flammable than fluid, is the loosening in the knit of me, the mixed fruit marmalade in the kitchen of me, wakes my disco and inner hibiscus, the Hector in the ever mess of my Troy. All wet mattress to my analysis, he stayed the loudest and longest of any house guest, is calling now as I write this, Tiny Bee, who brings the joy.
Tiny Bee.
Tiny Baby.
Yeah, I think this is a kind of house guest that you can't get rid of, right? This one's here to stay. I think it's her own child that we're getting here. I love the way that the poem has all this sense of raucous complaint, but it's usually about joy. It ends up being about joy and celebration of this life, right?
Yeah, despite all the interruptions and the noise and not doing any dishes and all the dribbling.
Right.
The mess of this life being described sort of stimulates a nice kind of jumble and joy in the poem.
The ever mess, the Hector in the ever mess of my Troy.
That's really wonderful. And then, of course, that's deflated immediately, if that's the right word, by the wet mattress.
Yeah, to my analysis. Let's hear another of these house guest poems from Idra Novi.
The name of this poem is La Prima Victoria, which is about a Chilean cousin, Victoria. And there's a reference in this poem to Clarice Lispector, who is a Brazilian novelist, and I recently translated a novel of hers called The Passion, according to G.H. It's about a woman who walks into a room and sees a cockroach emerging from an armoire and slams the door shut on the cockroach. And then over the course of the novel, after much metaphysical turmoil, comes to make lunch of it. La prima victoria. She expects nothing but to witness our lives and find kindness. And why shouldn't she? But for the boiling water my partner spills on my arm and the fuck's sake that escapes my mouth, now the snout of the spitting mammal in me. If there's a craft to the failing of simple expectations, I have mastered it, and majestically. But when there's something that must be said, it must be said, Le Spectre says, of a woman entering an empty room and finding a version of herself so dark it makes her pause and really see it. How she's no better than the cockroach in her closet, and so she eats it.
That's disturbing. Disturbing and funny. We both laugh at it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've been reading Le Spectre, you know, The Passion According to G.H. I don't think it's supposed to be very funny. It's very dark. It's very strange. And there is really quite a lot of what she calls metaphysical turmoil in it. It's just kind of labyrinthine thinking, you know, the darkness that comes out of thinking too much, and things become sort of disordered when you look at what's going on all around you. So it sort of one-ups Kafka a little bit.
If you mention the cockroach, you're bringing Kafka to mind, although that's definitely actually a vermin, I guess. The proper translation is a vermin. But the tone of this is interesting because it does have the kind of animalistic savagery to it, you know, the fuck's sake and the spitting mammal in me, you know, and also this grossness of the cockroach, and yet this bizarre buoyancy of the poem. I haven't read the book, so I'm surprised to find that it doesn't have the same tone.
I think it's a very different tone. One of the things you can hear in both the poems we're talking about is how real this is. This is just like how we live, isn't it? We're bumbling around in our houses and somebody spills hot water on us and swearing just comes out. And that agitation, both happy and angry making agitation, is kind of the real texture of our day-to-day life. And what I like about this is that, you know, in her encounter with the novel, she's not trying to imitate it.
She's
connecting with it and admitting it into the poem without trying to hijack it for her own purposes. The poet is very much herself in these poems.
And it's pretty amazing you can get from
she expects nothing but to witness our lives and find kindness,
which is how this opens up, to
and finding a version of herself so dark it makes her pause and really see it. How she's no better than the cockroach in her closet, and so she eats it.
And you've gotten this far in about 16, 17 lines here, you know. And that's what a poem can do. It takes you all the way through the sort of evolution of our consciousness, you know.
Yeah. I just, you know, the stuff about Hector and Troy and Le Spectre, it's so natural that she allows literature into her life. I think that's very heartening.
It's hard to do.
Yeah.
Let's listen to the last house guest poem that we have here in poetry. The title will help you figure out who G is in this poem.
Of the divine as absence and single letter. If our view were not a Holiday Inn, but a fringe of trees, I could say G here is our greenly hidden. If we lived amid Joe Pye weed and high grass instead of spackle and peeling plaster, I could say perhaps I'm listening to G now, but mean the owl, a wind playing the silo, a sticking sorrow, any sound but the snore of our latest visitor on the futon. Dear G, please make him turn, make me kinder. I'm not far from unfathoming it all.
That's a great last line.
Yeah.
Quite a disavowal.
It is a disavowal at the end, but it's also an avowal because the divine is absent. So I'm not far from unfathoming it all is another way in this poem of saying I'm not far from fathoming it all.
Right. Well, that's the poet's prerogative.
Right.
But here too, as in the other poems, there's a terrific sense of humor, you know, the funny religious overtones of a Holiday Inn.
Yeah, a spackle and peeling plaster. There's so many poems that seek to find a kind of mystical experience in the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a cliche. What rescues a poem like this is that sort of slant, cagey sense of humor, throwing in these details, Joe Pye weed and the visitor on the futon and the very real, actual things. Clive James has written more than 30 books, novels, memoirs, books of essays, and poetry, and he's currently working on a new translation of The Divine Comedy.
And every now and then, he pops off a witty essay about poetry for the magazine. And this month, we have his thoughts on what makes for a quotable poetic moment.
And we also have him on the phone from England. Hi, Clive.
Hi there.
So, Clive, the New York Times recently ran a piece about you saying basically that reports of your impending death had been greatly exaggerated.
I went through a phase quite recently when it was reported widely that I would die tomorrow. And I was very slow to step in to correct this rumor because all these wonderful tributes and eulogies were written and I was enjoying myself.
Right.
But finally I realized it would be the decent thing to say, look, it's not quite as decisive as that.
Well, Clive, in the essay in the magazine, you say that in your experience, poetry often gets into the mind through a side entrance. Can you talk about some of those side entrances in your life?
One of my big early occasions in my life where poetry made an impact was when I saw a production in Sydney in the late 1950s when I was still a student of O'Neill's play Long Day's Journey Into Night, which has throughout many occasions on which the characters quote the poetry of Ernest Dowson, standard stuff like They Are Not Long, The Weeping and the Laughter, Love and Desire and Hate. But it wasn't standard stuff to me. I'd never heard it. And I was entranced. And I went away and started reading Ernest Dowson. And for quite a while, he was my favorite poet. And that happened not because I'd found him on the page, but because his poems had found me in the theater. And I think that happens in everybody's life. My younger daughter discovered T.S. Eliot through Cats. And she knew all about Cats. She took me to it. A whole new generation was introduced to W.H. Auden by the Auden poem that was quoted in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and so on. It's this informal currency of poetry in the language and in conversation and in society that helps to spread it.
You talk about feeling a desire for a lot of great poems to be more compact and intense than they really are. Do you have some examples of that?
Well, I can think of a lot of poems in English with a big reputation that would be far better off if they were a lot shorter. Paradise Lost would be magnificent if it lasted for two pages. And I do find Paradise Lost intolerable. And one of the reasons is it's expansive in all the wrong ways. But I think there are a lot of long poems that would be better shorter. It doesn't apply to something like The Rime of the Ancient Mariner because it's meant to be like that. But there are poems that strain your patience and you wish that their content would have been compressed into something more portable. I think the day has passed now when you could inflict a long poem on the public. I'm about to do so, but it's Dante's Divine Comedy. It was his idea, not mine.
Well, this desire for compactness and intensity, is this modern?
It was always one of the ideals of poetry, but I don't think it was a fetish. What's tended to happen in modern times, and especially since Ezra Pound and the modernist movement, is that compression became a fetish. The image became the ideal. I like the idea because it suits my sense of economy. You get a lot for your money. And I've always liked the poems that pack a lot in, as long as they're sayable. Those two things can be in conflict sometimes. Empson, for example, sometimes verges on the unsayable, the unspeakable. His poems are full of content, but you've got to be able to recite them. Ideally, I think, the way the poem is organized is part of the information. The form tells you something about the poet's mood.
Let me pick up on that, the form saying about something about the poet's mood. And you say that your favorite poem is Keats's Ode to Melancholy. Now, why is that, and how does it fit into your appreciation of compact poems full of memorable phrases?
When I first got to London in the early 60s, in Keats's house in Hampstead, the manuscript of, I think it was Ode on Melancholy, maybe Ode to a Nightingale. My memory's starting to play me false nowadays. But it was in a glass case in the hallway, and you could see the poem written in his hand. He obviously relished the four-square neatness of it. And it's been my ideal of poetry all along. I love the basic English quatrain, rhyming A-B-A-B, is part of my DNA. Auden was a great master of it, and I learned a lot from Auden. That form has innate confidence. If you're talking about despair in rhyming quatrains, you'll still sound reasonably content with life. In fact, you tend to sound elated. It's because the form itself is so confident, so striding, so alive and vigorous, whereas there are other forms that languish more. You can think of them off the top of your head. As in fact, Keats's odes did tend to languish, but they were very, very tightly written within their structure. He put a lot into a phrase.
Clive, you fell in love with Ode on Melancholy when you were young. Haven't there been other poems over the years that might have knocked it off the top of your list?
Oh, yes. It happens still. The trouble is that I can name dozens, and I could start a recital right now and take up all your time and tape. But if it's a good poem, it starts being unforgettable straight away, and it drives everything else out of your head. In fact, if it doesn't drive everything else out of your head, it probably isn't successful. So for a moment, you think, well, this is the only poem. This is the one I've been waiting for. But I started feeling that quite early on, especially with Auden and MacNeice. MacNeice was a very, very powerful influence on my appreciation of poetry. A poem like The Sunlight on the Garden, I found myself learning it. In fact, I can still recite it. The sunlight on the garden hardens and grows cold. We cannot gauge the minute within its nets of gold. It has this tremendous technical trick in it. It's held together by a linkage of rhymes that work on the turnover. So the sound at the end of one line is the same sound as the beginning of the next line. The sunlight on the garden hardens and grows cold. That holds the poem together very, very tightly with this enormous strength. And within this enormous strength, the delicacy of the observation and the sentiments takes place. I was bowled over by MacNeice on every level, and still am. I think he was the great verse technician of the 20th century. I think it's the way into 30s poetry in England.
And Clive, you talk about reciting poems, and in the essay you mentioned reciting poems to your bathroom mirror. Do you ever do that anymore?
Yes, I still recite poems. I still recite my own. When a poem comes to me, a year went by until a few weeks ago. A whole year went by when I was so ill that nothing would come to me, and I thought it was all over. But then I got two or three poems in a row, and I know that the thing is alive when I find myself reading it out. I try and make everything I write, even in prose, pass that test. It must be sayable. But yes, I still recite the occasional line into the bathroom mirror, and the bathroom mirror reminds me nowadays that the man who is doing the reciting has lived a long time and ought to be getting good at this.
This comes up in your piece a little bit. Can you explain for us what John Dryden meant by a hit?
When Dryden talked about a hit, he wasn't talking about a hit song because there weren't any. He was talking about a lucky phrase. He was talking about that moment that a poet experiences when a word comes to him and he wasn't seeking that particular word, sometimes isn't ready for it when it arrives, but it just seems right, and he called that a hit. And I think he means that the phrase hit him, not that he hit on the phrase. I think any poet that we value has hits. He gets struck by lightning. Auden, of course, was all hits. When Auden wrote a phrase like, the earth turns over, and then he added, our side feels the cold, that whole thing is a hit. It just comes out of nowhere. Some poets are super rational and don't like to be surprised, but I don't think they write the kind of poems that I want to read. I don't say that poetry should be incoherent or unreasonable or surrealistic. In fact, I don't like any of those things. But I do think that it should be full of the kind of language which is vivid, which celebrates itself. The poetry I like best makes the language the hero.
Clive, you write, one can imagine a critical work of great length, which would consist of nothing but hit moments extracted from poems from the beginning of time, with a paragraph attached to each quoted moment speculating on how it came into the poet's mind. Any chance we could get you to write that book?
Well, the moment I wrote that down, I thought there were going to be publishers after me for that.
Yeah.
But it could be a very, very interesting critical work, I think.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Clive.
Thank you so much for your questions.
You can read Clive James's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the November 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.